Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. It is a delight always to have a chance to talk with the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's Readiness Subcommittee. His name is Rob Whitman. He represents the people of the 1st District of Virginia, where we've caught up with him today, I'm very pleased to say. He brings uncommon intelligence to the business of national defense, and it is a subject on which I know he's passionate, and we're deeply appreciative of his leadership. Congressman, welcome back. Good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's an honor and a privilege to be back with you.
You know, I thought of you immediately when I saw the other day a report that indicated of the 10 aircraft carriers that we have in the fleet these days, we only have 5 of them ready to be at sea and engage in operations, and none of them at the moment is assigned to the Middle East at a moment when, for reasons you know better than I, there is a lot of ferment taking place. As the chairman of the Shipbuilding Caucus, as a member of the Sea Power Subcommittee, as well as the chairman of the Readiness Committee, what do you make of this state of affairs, Congressman, the adequacy of our carrier battle groups to the tasks we're giving them?
Well, we absolutely need to have a full complement of 11 aircraft carriers, Frank. Today, as you know, we only have 10, which requires at some time not to have a presence in certain critical areas of the world. And obviously having a carrier in CENTCOM, in the Central Command, which would be there in the North Arabian Sea in that area, I think is critical when we have these periods of fairly short duration, but still an absence of U.S. presence there. It does create a challenge, and it's one of those things that we talk about constantly about the continued need to build aircraft carriers. It's our forward presence, and as we reduce base structure around the world, the only way we project forward presence is with those aircraft carriers. So it's important to make sure we stay on track and building new ones. The Gerald R. Ford will be delivered to the Navy in 2016, but remember, it will take that carrier a little short of 4 years before it becomes operational. That's because it's the newest carrier in a class, and a lot of testing has to go in to make sure that when it goes on deployment, it's ready to go. So that also elongates the time where we're going to be effectively with 10 carriers, and we have what's called a 2+3, that is 2 carriers, 4 deployed, 1 in the Central Command, 1 in the Pacific Command, and then 3 ready to go in case, and then they rotate what's called tiered readiness. So in order to have the ability to surge if necessary, you know, you have to have 11 because you always have one that's undergoing a refueling, one that's undergoing significant shipyard work, and time, too, for the sailors to rest, and then they have to retrain and get back. So, you know, folks look at it and go, well, gosh, why with 11 carriers do we only have, you know, it would be 6 for deployed there, but now with 10, we only have 5. That's the challenge it creates for us. And the world doesn't wait around and say, well, we'll wait for a carrier to come out of the yard. You know, we see things happening in the South China Sea, in the North Arabian Gulf, all those areas around the world. These threats continue, and U.S. presence is the way that we deter bad behavior, but also can respond in many ways to keep things from accelerating to points where it becomes very, very problematic for us.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about the South China Sea, Congressman Rob Whitman, because, of course, this is a place where we're seeing what I think has to be regarded as provocative behavior by the Chinese as they're manufacturing islands and fortifying them and then declaring them to be basically keep-out zones, whether they're anxious to have the resources or to control, you know, navigation through very important waters, as you know. Talk about, you know, what it means for us not to have a regular presence, let alone a permanent presence in those waters, to contest and, as you say, to deter possible bad behavior.
Well, you know, we have to have the presence there, Frank, and we do have agreements with countries in the region, from Australia to Singapore and you know, I've visited the Philippines a number of times. They have a strong desire to have a U.S. Navy presence there. They want to improve the Subic Bay facility so that we can berth ships there. They understand the importance of U.S. naval presence within that particular area. And it's the only way that we can realistically contest, as you said, the areas that China claims for itself. They're taking islands, the Spratly Islands, that belong to the Philippines, reclaiming those islands, which means they're pumping sand, building large, large land structures out of what are just tiny outcroppings of land in the South China Sea. And from that, too, they're improving those islands. So they're putting facilities on there that can support ships. There's only one reason you do that, and that is to be able to project that power into the Pacific. What we have to do is to contest that area under the International Treaty of the Seas. Those islands are not considered sovereign territory. So we can sail our warships within 12 miles of the borders of those islands, and we must do that because absent that, we then capitulate to China, and what they will claim is, well, nobody's contesting our claim, therefore it is. And we must understand that China is going to be aggressive. They're going to push the limits of what they believe their claims to be, even if it's counter to international law. And the United States is the only country, I think, on the face of the earth that can successfully contest China's claim in that area. And that means naval presence. And as you know, one of the things I've advocated for is a robust Navy. And we don't have enough ships now to have presence and to counter these threats around the world. And, you know, it's not just China. It's Russian presence now, especially with their new class of nuclear submarines. So those threats continue to materialize around the world.
We're going to be talking momentarily with Bill Gertz, who's been breaking stories about a new submarine drone. Let me ask you about one other issue in your large portfolio. The Natural Resources Committee is another that you serve on. President Obama, of course, since we last talked, has decided to block the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline in the United States. What are your thoughts on the implications of that decision, and will Congress try to overturn it?
Well, I know Congress will take every effort to allow the Keystone pipeline to be built, although it is an executive permitting process that allows that to happen. But I think there are some actions that Congress can take, at least in the meantime, to keep the issue in the forefront of people's minds. It's hard for us to circumvent the decision that's made by the president, but it doesn't mean that we can't continue to keep it in the forefront. And hopefully the next president will look at this differently. I think it's very problematic, Frank. It's problematic from an economic standpoint and the economic impact that it has in the United States. If there's a safety issue there, we know that oil can still come to the United States. It can come here on rail cars, and we've seen in recent history some of the disasters that have happened with the transportation of petroleum products on rail cars. So there's a safety issue there, and of course I would argue also an environmental issue there, with it being much less safe to transport it by rail car than it would be by pipeline. There's an energy independence component of that to make sure that we have the ability to produce energy for this nation to meet our demands. And a close partner like Canada that's willing to sell oil to us rather than countries in the Middle East, to me, it makes strategic sense to have that, not only with Canada as a partner, but to have that petroleum that we need in this country and refine it here to make sure we are less dependent on oil from nations that don't like us.
I couldn't agree more. Congressman, we have less than a minute with you. I just wanted to ask, going back to what might happen to that oil if we don't bring it here, is it will go to China. It might be used in a way that is even more damaging to the environment than it would be the case here. One of the things that is, of course, in play at the moment, speaking of carriers, is Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, has suggested that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be worth a carrier to the United States military because it will keep China out and help shore up our position in the Pacific. Have you taken a position on the TPP, and what do you make of that particular line of reasoning?
Well, Frank, as you know, recently the TPP has become available for us to read, and I am going through it, but I can tell you, in my beginning examination of that, I have deep, deep concerns and reservations about the TPP. And Frank, the only thing that replaces an aircraft carrier is an aircraft carrier. And while while Ash Carter may make assertions of what an agreement might do, there's nothing that replaces that sovereign 4.5 acres of U.S. sovereignty other than a United States aircraft.
Amen. We need more of them. We appreciate, again, what you're trying to do to make sure the ones we have are ready and the ones that we need are getting built. Congressman Rob Whitman of the 1st District of Virginia, keep up that good work, sir. God bless you, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Kevin Freeman joins us next. We'll talk about economic warfare and more right after this.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by my colleague and very good friend, Kevin Freeman, our senior fellow, the man we turn to on matters involving the economy, specifically economic warfare. He is the founder and CEO of Freeman Global Investment Council, also the founder of a marvelous new organization, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. He is the author of two best-selling books, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
I want to just very quickly ask you about an issue that we're focusing on fairly intensively here, because over the next few months, it's likely to consume a lot of time and energy in official circles, and that is something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We were just talking with Rob Whitman. Congressman Whitman is a member of the House Armed Services Committee, about the declining condition of the United States Navy, and specifically our carrier battle groups. Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, has, as you know, I'm sure, Kevin, declared that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is worth one carrier battle group. And I just wonder, I don't know if you've studied it intensively, but I just wonder whether you think that's likely coming out of the negotiating prowess of the Obama administration.
Well, we would all say that negotiating with the Iranians to end their nuclear development would be a good thing, but it depends on who's negotiating and how they're doing it. And I think the same thing applies here, that the TPP is so complex. I would not trust them. Obviously, we believe in global trade, and we believe in all the kinds of things that would make the world safer, but I would not trust this massive document that few people have read and fewer understand any more than I trusted Obamacare.
Yeah, and the idea that the United States Senate is going to go along, as will the House now, with essentially a take-it-or-leave-it kind of approach to this deal can only reinforce those concerns. Kevin Freeman is our guest, of our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and founder and CEO of Freeman Global Investment Council. And Kevin, one of your books, as I mentioned, is Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And it prominently features discussion of the threats to our grid, notably from electromagnetic pulse, cyber warfare, and the like. Along comes Ted Koppel. What did you make of his new book, Lights Out, and the contribution it might make to sort of raising public awareness, as you've been trying to do now for some time?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily helpful to have Ted Koppel. He's revered as an elder figure from the media. He is appreciated by me that he raised cyber warfare as a very serious threat. It doesn't really delve into the other aspects of risk to our grid, but he's absolutely accurate that other nation states and indeed terror groups have the capability of hacking our systems, taking down the grid with catastrophic loss of life. And those things should not be ignored.
You got into an interesting controversy with Salon Magazine that seemed to think that this whole problem had been discovered when Ted Koppel came upon it. That, of course, isn't so. But you made a larger point here that this should not be a partisan issue. And yet partisans like the Salon Magazine folks are similarly determined to make it such. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, immediately, you know, after Ted comes out with this, it's revelation to them, and wow, his facts are fantastic. And no one on the right, they said, no one on the right has even addressed this. And so I responded back to them with a comment, absolutely. Well, Judge Jeanine has done a great job. You've done a great job. Peter Price done a great job. This isn't a partisan issue. They tried immediately to say those Republicans are a problem because they won't even admit this exists. And that's just simply not factual. People from all political stripes have been sounding this warning for years, virtually ignored by the left, virtually ignored by Congress. Finally, we're beginning to pay attention and say there is a problem here and maybe we should study it. We need to do more than study it. We need to shore up our grid as soon as possible.
I'm pretty keen on doing that, particularly in your native state of Texas, as a way to lead the nation. Texas having its own grid, it seems to me to be the perfect candidate for that. We appreciate your efforts to sound the alarm on this and your pushback against those who are both ignoring the history here and also trying to turn, sort of to partisan advantage, something that should be truly the ultimate transpartisan issue. It will affect all of us if, God forbid, the grid goes down. Let me turn to something else you've been writing about recently. And again, Kevin Freeman is our guest. He is deeply knowledgeable about economics and particularly energy economic issues. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the proposition that we may have won the oil war, as it's called, Kevin.
Well, the Saudis and OPEC made a strategic decision that they're going to try and maintain production rather than maintain price. We don't know what the free market price for oil is. We haven't had a free market in oil for decades because there's a cartel involved, and normal free markets function differently. But this time they decided that the shale development plays in America, the American oil producers, were getting too much market share, so they would just pump as much oil as they could, make them non-economic, and drive them out of business. What they found is that American technology is very flexible, and that we've adjusted our costs of producing oil and maintained business and maintained more market share than they'd expected. And the Saudis are facing a huge capital crunch. They have a massive social network that they pay for, requiring at least $80 and maybe $100 a barrel for oil, and they're spending down their reserves rapidly. This is creating all kinds of chaos economically and in the oil markets that we have not seen exactly how it's going to end, but they did not, as of now, drive the shale players out of business.
Yeah, this is important on several different fronts, obviously in terms of our economy, but also the stability of the Saudi kingdom is probably increasingly in question at a moment when there isn't a whole lot of stability in the Arab and Muslim world. And Kevin, do you anticipate that this could ultimately translate into the Saudis losing, the Saudi royal family, that is, losing control, and what comes then?
Well, according to the IMF, and I think that the IMF is overly optimistic, they have about 5 years of hard currency reserves that they can use to continue at low oil prices. My statistics show it's closer to 2 years, but absolutely it lends to instability. If you're not able to pay for the people that live in your nation and give them the benefits that they're used to, there could easily be an uprising, especially when you have strong groups like ISIS that are demanding, and al-Qaeda that are demanding the end of the monarchies because they're not holding true enough to the Islamic faith.
And large numbers, we're told, of young people both in Saudi Arabia and some of the other emirates, that there is this large youth population bulge that is largely underemployed. And these funds are necessary to sort of pay them to stay on the job, or at least not raise trouble with ISIS or otherwise. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'd hope to talk with you about immigration as economic warfare, another issue on which you're knowledgeable and have been writing, but that's for another day. In the meantime, thank you very much for your time today and the terrific work you're doing, notably with the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. It's an incredibly important initiative, as is your work at Freeman Global Holdings. We'll look forward to talking with you next week. Next up, we'll be speaking with Bill Gertz. He'll take us inside the ring. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Monday, the House of Representatives is expected to take up an important legislative initiative. It's called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, or CIPA. If enacted, it would require the federal government to develop a strategy for hardening the U.S. electric grid from various threats that could take it down with devastating effects on our country and people. The good news is that CIPA is supposed to prompt the mapping of the grid's myriad vulnerabilities and the identification of necessary corrective actions. The bad news is that this bill won't, in and of itself, actually protect anything. Still, we need the first step that the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act prescribes to be approved by Congress and signed into law at the earliest possible moment. We're not only on notice about the threat, we're on borrowed time. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securethegrid.com.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Bill Gertz, our duty expert on what's going on inside the ring. Of course, Inside the Ring is the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, the author of 6 best-selling books on China, among other things. We are always pleased to have him with us, and no more so than today when he is redoubling the extraordinary investigative work that he's been doing on a story that has not gotten nearly enough attention elsewhere, to my way of thinking, namely a new drone submarine that the Russians are beginning to bring to bear against, apparently, targets like our ports. Bill Gertz, welcome. It's always good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
So I recall you broke this story in the West. Tell us a little bit about this drone and what the latest developments have been, including apparently a little bit of publicity to it from Vladimir Putin, no less.
Yeah, it's an important story. Several months ago, I broke a story that the Russians were developing a secret underwater, long-range, high-speed, nuclear-tipped drone submarine capable of carrying a multi-megaton warhead, enough to blow up entire cities, or in this case, harbors. That program was deeply held. Its NATO code name was Canyon, K-A-N-Y-O-N, and just this week, Russian President Vladimir Putin had a meeting with his national security advisors in Sochi, Russia. And during the filming of that program, a Russian military officer was shown looking over a document, and there on the document, according to observers who were able to catch a glimpse of it and it went viral on the internet, was this mock-up of this underwater drone. It would be delivered on an Oscar II-class attack submarine. It's big enough that it has to be carried outside of the submarine, and it was identified as planning for doing enormous damage to the economies of enemy countries. So this is a significant development, and it's certainly something that is a wake-up call for the West here in dealing with the new threat of underwater nuclear drones.
Now, Bill, you have been covering these issues for a long time. Is there any chance, in your professional judgment, that that was an accident by the Russians, or do you think this was very much designed to telegraph a threatening new capability?
It's not clear. Basically, the Russian presidential spokesman said that it was a mistake, and Russian TV was ordered to withdraw the video footage. However, it's out there on the internet. Anybody can see it. We have a still photo on the Free Beacon website. And it could be disinformation as well. It could be designed to fool the U.S. intelligence after the disclosure of it in my story about this new weapon system. So we really don't know. But from all intents and purposes, it looks like it was an accidental disclosure of classified information, although some people think that it was deliberately disclosed to let the United States know that they're working on this weapon.
Yeah. A threat not just to our economy, of course, but obviously to vast numbers of Americans, should it be brought to bear against us. Bill, as usual, congratulations on that scoop. Let me ask you about another one. The Chinese have apparently conducted their eighth test of an anti-satellite system. You've been covering this story extraordinarily well as well. Talk a little bit about what the latest test suggests and what its implications might be.
Yeah, this was a test of what's called the Dongning 3 anti-satellite exo-atmospheric vehicle test. It took place October 30th at a place called Korla, which is in western Xinjiang province. And the test was actually there were contrails from the missile that were posted on the Chinese internet. And this is, a significant development. The Obama administration declined to comment on it. They're keeping this secret because it's, again, an indication that China is working on weapons that can attack our extremely vulnerable satellite constellations, which are used from everything from logistics to intelligence to command and control, and of course, as well as in the civilian sector as well. Last year, when they conducted a test in July, the Assistant Secretary of State for Verification, Frank Rose, came out and said this was not a missile defense test, as the Chinese claimed. This was an anti-satellite test, and they're alarmed by the fact that China is weaponizing and preparing for a conflict in space.
Yeah, you know, we're endlessly told by the Chinese that they've wanted to prevent the proliferation of weapons into space. They wanted arms control agreements for that purpose. This would seem to be just another example, is it not, Bill Gertz, of deception on their part and stealing a march on us in a way that could be of enormous strategic consequence, not just militarily, but economically as well.
Yes, the Chinese are working very hard to develop an array of space weaponry. That's going to be disclosed formally in a Congressional China Commission report that's due out next week. And they've outlined not just direct ascent anti-satellite missiles, but an array of maneuvering small satellites that can crash in and grab satellites, ground-based lasers, ground-based electronic jammers that can disrupt the signals and intercept the signals. So this is a new frontier of emerging conflict.
Yeah. And again, Bill, you've done an extraordinary job, I think, of trying to track this for the rest of us, because it's hard to imagine what would be our condition militarily, projecting forces, coordinating military operations and the like, as well as in terms of our commercial sector and everything we depend upon, should the Chinese decide to utilize these capabilities to exercise the dominion of the high frontier, as it's been called. Bill, let me turn to another topic. You have broken a story about something that seems like a throwback to my early days in this business, the idea of the United States having a mobile intercontinental ballistic missile. I remember vividly, both before I started working for President Reagan and during my time with him, the controversies about rail mobile systems and road mobile systems that were then considered to be both needed and doable. It's hard to believe that the Obama administration is actually going to pursue this idea. Talk a little bit about what's going on and more generally kind of the nuclear status of our capabilities.
Well, first of all, the land-based leg of our nuclear triad, the Minuteman III missile, is aging rapidly, and it's not going to last forever. So the Air Force has been tasked and gone to contractors to look at what the future land-based ICBM force is going to look like, and that's where this has come in. They have three options on the table. They've been out there in the contracts for proposal. The Air Force isn't talking publicly about it, but from the contract, you can see that they want to somehow continue upgrading the Minuteman III so that it will be useful through 2075. A second option is to build a new silo-based replacement for the Minuteman III. And then the third option is a mobile, road mobile, and actually rail mobile ICBM force. Again, the advantages of mobility is that it makes it very difficult for an adversary to target those weapons. The latest is that it looks like they may go to a silo-based new missile that could also be placed on a mobile transporter erector launcher.
Do you think, Bill, that this is something that will come to fruition, or is this just sort of throwing money at some contractors to do some studies? Again, I have some very hard scars from those early days where, again, a president who was deeply and personally committed to modernizing our nuclear forces, and we frankly have been living off of the fruits of his efforts for all these years, there's no evidence of anything like that sentiment on the part of this president. So is this,
Memorex? People in charge of deterrence look at the danger of explosion of mobile missiles. The Chinese are building a whole series of new mobile missiles. The Russians have their mobile missiles. They're also going to a rail mobile system. So I think that the nature of the threat is driving the military and the policymakers to the reality that they need to do something to counter those missiles.
Yeah, and not least the North Koreans are getting into the game as well. And I imagine if they are, the Iranians will be shortly, and perhaps others. I'm not decrying the idea. Trust me on this. I think it makes eminent sense. And the modernization of both these platforms and of the nuclear weapons that sit atop them seems to me to be long overdue. So we'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Bill Gertz of the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon. I'm always disappointed that we don't have time to cover all of the things that you've been talking about lately, including the jihad on campus. But that will be for next week, I hope, and we look forward to talking with you then. Next up, we'll be talking with Stephen Coughlin, one of the country's great experts on the jihad inside the Beltway. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by another senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He is Major Stephen Coughlin, United States Army Reserves, now retired, the author of several extraordinarily important works, including Catastrophic Failure, The Blindfolding of America in the Face of Jihad, and most recently, a new monograph for the Center for Security Policy's Civilization Jihad Reader Series entitled Bridge Building to Nowhere, The Catholic Church's Case Study in Interfaith Delusion. He is a man who served with great distinction in the military of this country, including as what amounted to the duty expert of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for matters involving the enemy threat doctrine, Sharia, as he's taught me, is the way that the enemy tends to think of it as. And he has been extraordinarily effective, including in a presentation he made to the Act for America Northern Virginia chapter just last night. I was not able to be there in person, but was represented and had very, very high acclaim for your performance there. Steve, tell us a little bit about what you shared with the folks in Northern Virginia last night.
Thank you for having me on the show, Frank. What the brief really did was it really starts to tries to make it makes its first run at explaining the interfaith movement. And, of course, the question I raise is, you realize that you put pressure on a local politician or your congressman because they're doing stuff with the Brotherhood, or you're starting to call out the Brotherhood in your local area, and all of a sudden the Islamic Society Mosque decides to have a media event where people are invited, and of course there'll be some local politicians, and they're on the stage when you decide to go and ask hard questions. Will be that priest, minister, and rabbi, and lo and behold, you get your question up. You get your question out challenging the imam for the Brotherhood connections, and you don't even get a response from him. If you're Jewish, you get a response from the rabbi. If you're Catholic, it's the priest, and if you're a Protestant or evangelical, it's the minister. And you know, all of a sudden, I started to realize, what the heck is that? You know, what's going on here? Because, you know, I was just in Omaha, Nebraska last week talking to a minister, and he said of all the times he's challenged the local Islamic society's mosque, he's never once got an exchange with the imam. It was always the minister. And so I thought it started to become really important from the national security point of view to start to account for the fact that the Brotherhood operatives who would, you know, schmooze with our politicians and senior leaders always had the local clergy in the bag. And that's really what started the analysis. And what I found was that this is one of those areas where you really have to make a decision to take to heart that saying from Carlos the Jackal, that there's an active alliance between a radical Islam and Marxist. Because what I found was that the Muslim Brotherhood uses the interfaith movement to get the denominations, Jewish and Christian, to do their bidding. And on a deeper review, it turned out that the interfaith movement was created by the IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation, which, of course, was formed by Saul Alinsky. And it's always interesting when you show the slide where that pops up, where people just go back in their seat.
Steve Coughlin, this interfaith dialogue business or bridge building that you've chronicled so well in your new monograph, Bridge Building to Nowhere, is really just one facet of what you've laid bare in terms of the larger enterprise the Muslim Brotherhood has called Civilization Jihad. As concerning as this is, this interference being run for the Islamic supremacists by people of other faiths, I know you're also concerned about the inroads that are being made in other institutions, including in our government, by the Muslim Brotherhood. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this so-called countering violent extremism program and what that's about in practice and what its implications are if it's not challenged.
Well, I think it could be said that working through the Center for Security Policy and the briefs I've been giving, we've been calling this out for a very long time, and now it's hitting a critical mass. If you go back to when the CARE was, you would see a trending left media entity like Wired Magazine or NPR come up with some bogus expose talking about what we're doing, immediately followed by a CARE release.
That's the Council on American Islamic Relations, of course, one of the Muslim Brotherhood associated organizations in America.
Exactly. That's when they decided to have DHS take over the counterterror mission, and all of a sudden it stopped being counterterrorism and it started being violent extremism as a matter of unstated policy. Well, my view is the CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, is a piece of paper that covers over the actual counterterror laws and statutes, so that instead of doing counterterror, you're doing outreach to the community, even though your statutory mission is to stop terrorism. And all of a sudden, you start to realize that the CVE language doesn't sound anything like something that would support the Constitution.
And Steve, let's just drill down on that, because this is really a critical insight. Reaching out to the community, by which you mean the Muslim community in America, of course, has supplanted counterterrorism because of the notion, which, let's face it, has been promoted incessantly by Muslim Brotherhood associated individuals who have been advisors to the Obama administration, and before that to the Bush administration, that in fact the terrorists can only be countered if you in fact are getting on board the community largely dominated now, unfortunately, by the Brotherhood. So, I mean, we're really being sold a bill of goods here, it would seem.
Well, after the window dressing of other groups, it really is the Muslim Brotherhood. And going back to when DHS first started standing up the CVE practices inside DHS, Department of Homeland Security, the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Division, they brought in the Muslim Brotherhood to help them set it up. So we know that they were involved in this. In fact, it was Judge Chertoff, when he was still at DHS under the Bush administration, who brought them in to first start the purge of the language. This becomes very important because once we started working, doing community outreach with our Brotherhood partners, all of a sudden they took away our language, the only language that defines the threat of groups like Al-Qaeda and, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. This is important because, you know, you will find right now that the very groups like CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, who helped set up the CVE, are now all of a sudden protesting it. So you're thinking, oh, wow, now the Brotherhood's turning against it because they'll see how bad it is. But actually, you find at the same time that MPAC is still pushing it, and internationally they're still pushing it.
That would be the Muslim Public Affairs Council, which is kind of a 3.0 generation of Brotherhood fronts, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. But here becomes the very big insight. If you ever take a look at it, you'll see that no matter how much an article or a statement about violent extremism might start with Bin Laden and Tora Bora, it always ends with somebody defending the Constitution. And this becomes important because as MPAC, Muslim Public Affairs Council, and internationally they're still pushing it hard, the CVE, you find that publicly, in the public media face, CARE is protesting it. Why? Because they want the CVE to move forward after its intended target, which is not Muslim terrorist or the Muslim Brotherhood. It's people who believe that the oath to support and defend the Constitution is worth fighting for. And I mean that literally, because if you believe in something so hard that you'd stand up for it, you're an extremist. And if you'd fight for it, you're a violent extremist. And what you find is you find the DHS and the other law enforcement agencies increasingly use this Southern Poverty Law Center language to basically categorize people who believe in the Constitution as the violent extremists. And that becomes the issue with the CVE.
It's a matter of deflection on the one hand, and also being able to undermine the people who are most effective in challenging and exposing what the Brotherhood and other Islamic supremacists are up to in this country. You are among those, Stephen Coughlin, the author of Catastrophic Failure. We're talking about, as the subtitle suggests, the blindfolding of America in the face of jihad. We're going to have a chance to talk with Stephen Coughlin at greater length in a moment. Stay tuned for more on the Muslim Brotherhood in America and what we better be doing to counter it, with Stephen Coughlin right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined for another segment by our friend Stephen Coughlin, senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, the former duty officer and expert on the Joint Chiefs of Staff for matters involving Sharia and the enemy threat doctrine. He is also the author of several very important books, including Catastrophic Failure, The Blindfolding of America in the Face of Jihad, and Bridge Building to Nowhere, a new monograph subtitled The Catholic Church's Case Study in Interfaith Delusion. And we've been talking about delusions of various kinds, Steve. Give us a flavor of what's being done at the moment to try to suppress freedom of speech that might expose some of this activity, including your own?
Well, you know what? I think I could give you three examples right off the bat. And I think all three of them can come home and hit us. One is this last May, a man named David Shipler came out, and I think the name of the book was Freedom of Speech, and what this book is about. And in fact, they targeted us in one of the chapters called Protocols of the Elder Islam, accusing us of being anti-Islamic the way the Protocols of the Elder Zion is rapidly anti-Semitic. And what it does is it lays down the post-First Amendment free speech standard. Free speech is what is allowed, and hate speech is what will be tolerated. But once that paradigm is established, they're going to criminalize that hate speech and the people who put it out. And it will be the state that makes that determination. A second example is that now we're having clear information. Of course, I think CSP, you guys hosted the event in September 2012 when I gave a presentation on Benghazi that said what happened at Benghazi was a complete whitewash. And now groups like Judicial Watch are getting Freedom of Information documents that show, one, that we have 100% knowledge that Hillary Clinton, the people on the ground, knew that the people attacking them at the time were Al-Qaeda, and it was an Al-Qaeda attack. Two, we have absolute knowledge now that the State Department, from Hillary Clinton to Rashad Hussein to Quinton Wiktorowicz, who was at the White House at the time, were busy working with the OIC, the Organization for Islamic Cooperation and the Domestic Brotherhood, to turn what happened in Benghazi into a discussion on violent extremism, a la the YouTube video clip. We know that they knew that that was not true when they did it. And what they overwrote the facts on the ground, the killing of a U.S. diplomatic officials, was the CVE narrative. So this is something, you know, of course, my classic brief is the disappearing language. We see that the CVE exists to overwrite facts in play, statutory law. And just recently, you guys had me go out to Warsaw, Poland, where we literally saw the emergence of all this stuff written in Russian, translated in English, about what the new hate speech laws are supposed to be. And I think what people need to understand first and foremost is if we can't tag it with the OIC or the Muslim Brotherhood, we could tag it with the hard left, Soros or the Russians. That this stuff coming at us in every direction, from the hard left on the flank to the Brotherhood in our front to the OIC and the international community, these things are completely synchronized.
You know, there's one other dimension of this, Steve, that usually goes unnoted in this context, at least, and that is an effort that's been made in the United States Senate by Democratic members there, led by Harry Reid, to amend the First Amendment of the Constitution in order to change it to restrict political speech. And boy, you start tinkering with that fundamental foundational freedom and document, there's no knowing where it will wind up, especially with this overlay, as you've just described. Steve, let me ask you about another initiative. Speaking of the United States Senate, Senator Ted Cruz there and in the House, Mario Diaz-Balart have introduced legislation to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. You've been going to school on the Brotherhood longer and with greater effect than just about anybody I know. Do you think such a designation is warranted? And if it were to be designated in this fashion, what would that mean for groups like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, the Islamic Society of North America, the North American Islamic Trust, and on and on and on, groups that have been identified by a senior Muslim Brotherhood operative himself as elements of the Brotherhood's sort of infrastructure in America?
Not only identified by senior Muslim Brotherhood operatives, but admitted into evidence in the federal court of law that upheld a challenge. I think that it's long, long overdue. I think that the problem we have, starting with the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, in 2007, is with the Brotherhood helping us understand the war on terror in the Middle East and letting them help us understand the community in America, we were convinced at the national security level that the moderate Muslim Brotherhood is the alternative to radical Al-Qaeda. Now, what supports that view is that the Muslim Brotherhood says so. But what argues against it is the same people who trust them and captured them actually saying that the only reason they talk to us is to subvert us.
It's like the interfaith dialogue business, isn't it, that this is all about subversion?
If I could give an example, if we see the minister, priest, and rabbi doing the bidding of the Muslim Brotherhood in the interfaith world. What we see through this issue in Congress with the Muslim Brotherhood is that the Brotherhood, they're either the moderate alternative that they insist, or if we follow the facts, they are the mothership on which every one of these radical groups come. And they're on record as saying they only work with us to subvert us.
Yeah. Remind us, Steve, again, Steve Coughlin, let me just ask you, in that document to which we've been both referring, the explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal of the group in North America, written by Muhammad Akram in 1991, as a report back to that mothership in Egypt, introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial. What was the mission statement of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America, just for calibration purposes on whether it's a terrorist group or not and should be designated as such?
Well, I think the catchphrase in that is civilization jihad by our hand. And civilization jihad is clearly explained in terms of deep penetration and subversion.
Yeah, but more to the point, destroying Western civilization from within, as I recall, is it not? So this is not the moderate group that's been made out to be. It's not a moderate alternative any more than Al-Qaeda is to the Islamic State or any of these other guys, is it?
It's not just that they're not moderate. It's that you cannot have an actual factual analysis to prove that. So what you have is the supremacy of schmoozing and feeling good meeting somebody over the facts on the ground that people who swore to support and defend the Constitution are looking past to get that feel-good movement is celebrating diversity.
And that's the catastrophic failure that you've been documenting in your book, among other places. One other thing that you've been involved in addition to your travels in OSCE, as it's called, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in Warsaw, you've been to Egypt a couple of times in recent years, and you've had a chance to talk to people who've been confronting the Brotherhood on its home ground for some time. Give us a sense of what the LCC government is up to there and whether they deserve our support to a degree that they've not been getting it from the U.S. government today.
Well, I think that the Sisi government has openly declared their hostility to the Muslim Brotherhood and are seeking their destruction. And I think that when we've met with some people in Egypt, they have been very helpful to try to show us their terrorist roots, their current terrorist activities. I think there's a lot of things going on in Egypt that when we see something violent happen, we kick it over and say, well, that's a ISIS front group. But you can always show that the Brotherhood is deeply involved in these things. And so that what they're doing is they're helping us show that their international reputation is that. I think they're also deeply concerned that just as in the 80s when Hamas was kind of run out of the Palestinian territories, that they're worried that the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood today, who they're trying to capture, will move to the West in places like Virginia and London and camp out and then return.
I must say I'm a little concerned about it, too, as are you. Hence your important speech last night to the ACT of Northern Virginia chapter in the part of the world that is, I'm afraid, very much in the crosshairs of the Muslim Brotherhood today. Steve Coughlin, our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much for the great work you're doing on so many of these fronts. Please, folks, check out Catastrophic Failure and Bridge Building to Nowhere, two of Steve's very important works. Come back to us again next week, if you will. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.